You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new UW-Madison study finds that even though the environment is changing, water quality in Midwestern lakes has stayed mostly the same. The author of the study joins us with the details. Now, veterans receiving dental care at the VA hospital in Toma could have been exposed to dangerous diseases such as hepatitis. The allegation is that tools and other instruments were not properly sterilized after use. A new report from the Inspector General has recommendations for the best ways to prevent this from happening in the future. Commander Laurel Kluhl joins us now. She's the state commander of the Wisconsin American Legion. Laurel, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm sure you've had your eye on the Toma VA facility for a while. What was your reaction to this latest Inspector General report on possible exposure to illnesses?
We are a little disheartened and a little more concerned, I think, than they are. I'm kind of shocked and a little bit surprised after all the other issues with the opioid and stuff that this dental incident issue came up. Kind of disturbing.
And do you think that now that this report is out, are you hopeful that Toma and the people there are going to take this seriously and fix this problem?
I sure hope so. I think we really have dedicated staff at the Toma Center, and I believe that they all think, like we do, that veterans deserve better. But I think the employees, I think, have to feel a little bit more confident with that coming out. But I really believe that the culture has to change.
Yeah, it seems like there's a trend, whether we're talking about the opioid prescribing problem, which was the big scandal at Toma, or this, it seems like there's a long lag between when people first start to see a problem and when it gets noticed more widely and when action is taken. What do you think it would take to get a faster turnaround time to fix things?
Well, truthfully, I'm just going to say, I think employees have to feel more confident in the leadership, that they can actually come forward with things. They're the ones that are boots on ground, and they actually see it. So if we aren't asking them, then they have to feel comfortable actually making that known to us. You know, Trump signed the Whistleblower Act, and I think that was a good step, but it still comes down to people have to have confidence in the leadership.
Right. Ideally, there'd be a situation where if I saw a problem there, I wouldn't have to be a whistleblower to raise this as an issue. You'd have a mechanism to deal with that, and it seems like that hasn't been there, has it?
No, and I think part of that problem is I think they have to do more inspections, you know, spot inspections, impromptu inspections. Maybe they have to be a little bit more visible on site. The IG really has to get more involved, I think.
What have you heard from veterans in Wisconsin about conditions at Toma? Is this something that they're raising to you at the American Legion?
I think mainly what we hear is that everything is good. And like I said, that the employees are wonderful and that they're dedicated and they really want to make the system work. The Legion actually feels it's a system worth saving. So I believe that most veterans get pretty good care there, and I haven't heard anything really negative except, you know, the few things that keep coming up in the news. But with that being said, I don't know if we don't have those kind of situations at our other VA clinics because of the outside connections. Like the one in Madison has the Madison medical team that's always there. I mean, maybe Toma needs more of that on-site, you know, more visible inspection type thing to keep them all in check.
That's an interesting point that I hadn't come across before. Is Toma's facility in Wisconsin unique in that it doesn't have those kind of partnerships?
Right. From what I'm going to be doing my hospital visits in the next few months. Mm-hmm. So what I've heard from our state adjutant and different people is that we actually are connected, like Iron Mountain facility, Madison facility, Zablocki, they all have different connections with the medical teams down there. So I think Toma is a little bit unique in that respect.
We're talking to Commander Laurel Kluhl, State Commander of the Wisconsin American Legion, about the Tomah VA facility, some recent news there about an Inspector General report, and about the VA system more generally. And Commander Kluhl, you mentioned earlier about Tomah specifically, that it's a system worth saving. Is that how you see the VA in general, too? Do veterans generally get, apart from the scandals we see or the bad news we see, is this generally a good system that just needs some fixes?
Yes, that's the overall, is that it's a good system and it's a system worth saving. Veterans, they have unique problems and issues that I think VAs can deal with on a more personal level. So I believe that we just have to keep trying to improve on what we have rather than totally disrupt a good system.
And what do you see happening in the VA system and from federal leadership when it comes to fixing some of the problems so that the system can work as well as it can?
Well, the American Legion goes to Washington every year to discuss these issues with the Veterans Affairs Commission. And we tell them every year it's a system worth saving. We feel that we've brought to them a few things, you know, updating computer systems, updating, you know, the lines of communication between the different medical facilities around the state. It's one of those technical things that I think that I think we all lack in getting staying that connected. And in a system like the VA or in the medical, I think all medicals, and maybe this is me talking, but I've talked to a few outside of the VA system who they struggle with being able to connect with a medical field that because they don't have a technology that talks to each other, so they're not compatible. And I really think that that's one of the issues we keep bringing to the federal VA, is that we need to get all of this compatible. So when somebody goes to the Appleton VA clinic, they know what the person has done down in the Milwaukee clinic. And because there's different spots throughout the state that veterans have to go to. My husband, for example, is a Vietnam veteran who went to the Appleton clinic here. I live in Appleton, or we do, and they told him he needed hearing aids. Well, they can't just do that there, which is kind of crazy if you ask me. But so then he had to make an appointment at the Green Bay facility, and that's where he had to go to get the hearing aids. It took 6 months. That's unacceptable in my eyes. I believe that if we had more of a compatible and more of a system that actually worked together, that those appointments and those needs could be met faster.
As we start to wrap up, I just want to mention, of course, yesterday the 9/11 anniversary that started a chain of events that led to a lot of American service members serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere and needing this kind of care now from VA. Can you just talk about the importance of making sure we have a quality healthcare system for America's veterans?
You know, what we're coming back to, what the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are coming back to, are a lot of unique situations. Now, I say that because in Vietnam, I'm going to guess, and I wasn't there, but I'm going to guess a lot of those people didn't come back without limbs and things because we didn't have the technology that we have today. So we have to start addressing the unique problems that are facing our young veterans and our veterans of today. PTSD wasn't talked about then. It's talked about now. We have to keep learning from our veterans as they come back what the needs are, and we have to keep updating and getting involved with all those veterans coming back.
Commander Kluhl, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Laurel Kluhl is the state commander for the Wisconsin American Legion. She joins today to talk about recommendations being handed down from the Inspector General following improper sterilization practices at the Tomah VA dental facility, which potentially expose veterans to dangerous diseases. Coming up, we talk with the author of a new study that finds water quality in Midwestern lakes remaining steady despite changes in the environment. Stay with us here on Central Time. Climate change, big agriculture, and new industries have all raised concerns in recent years about their impact on Wisconsin's lakes and rivers. Many fear that water quality will deteriorate without stronger regulations and enforcement. A new study from the UW finds that despite changes in the environment, the condition of lakes in Wisconsin and beyond remains largely the same. Samantha Oliver is a graduate student in UW-Madison's Department of Limnology and lead author of the study that examined nearly 3,000 U.S. lakes. She joins us here in the studio. Samantha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What were you setting out to find out about lakes?
Yeah, so we wanted to know, how have lakes changed since around 1990? Since then, we know that large environmental changes have occurred in the U.S. and beyond. But certainly in this region of the Midwest and the Northeast United States, we know that the climate is getting warmer. We have more extreme rain events. But at the same time, we've been spending billions of dollars to try to manage nutrients on the landscape. And so we wanted to know how those things combined to sum up to water quality in lakes.
And it sounds like the short version is, if you'll pardon me, we're treading water. We're kind of staying the same in lake quality.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. There have been other studies that have sort of shown the same thing. A few lakes are worsening in water quality. A few places are getting better. But overall, most lakes are not changing. And we think that's because, you know, even though we're trying really hard and spending a lot of money to improve water quality, we're sort of running uphill against climate change and other things that are worsening.
And it sounds like there's two responses from the scientific community, and they are, hey, this is good news. It's not getting worse despite all these things that could be making it worse. Or it's bad news. We're putting all this effort into water quality and it's not getting better.
Yeah, that basically describes every reaction I've gotten from any other scientist who I've spoken with. And I sort of think of it as the glass half empty, glass half full perspectives. And certainly I sort of share those changing viewpoints on looking at the study. Yes, it could be interpreted as good news. I think there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. You know, we think of the Madison Lakes or Lake Erie, where there are large algal blooms, and we might have this perception that water quality is actually getting worse. So we really wanted to know, let's zoom out beyond sort of the individual lake perspective and see how things are changing.
And let's talk about what it means for a lake to be healthy. What kind of measures were you looking at?
Yeah, so I think what a healthy lake is depends on who you ask. From my perspective, that generally means the lake isn't green. You might be able to see your hand when you put it in the water. There's enough oxygen for fish to live. Those are kind of the general characteristics that scientists use to describe whether a lake is healthy or not. And so in this study, we used a proxy for how much algae is in the water column called chlorophyll. And then we measured the nutrients that those algae need to grow and reproduce.
And these are algae we don't want too much of, is that right?
Right. That's what makes the lakes green. That's what sort of produces bad water quality. Every lake has algae, but when you get too much, you get other problems in the lake.
Right. Like the algae absorbs too much of the oxygen, is that right, for the fish and other species?
Yeah. So the algae grow, they decompose, they fall to the bottom of the lake, and bacteria that break them down consume the oxygen, and then there is no oxygen for organisms like fish.
So that's what we're measuring in terms of health. And then what are some of the things happening in or I guess near the water that are threats to that health?
Yeah, so there are some major threats that we think of sort of in the United States for lake water quality. A big one of them, two big ones are urbanization. So when we pave over the landscape no longer can sort of hold on to rain and nutrients from the landscape. The second thing is agriculture. So farmers put a lot of nutrients on the landscape. They produce cows that produce manure, and that manure has to go somewhere. And so generally, they put it back on the fields, and then those nutrients end up in our waterways.
What kind of efforts are there out there to control the runoff of those nutrients and the problems of urbanization that affect lakes here in Wisconsin and the Midwest in general?
Yeah, that's sort of what we were interested in this study, because there have been some national scale management efforts to try to improve water quality. One of those was the Clean Air Amendments in 1990 that were largely focused on trying to mitigate acid rain. But a byproduct of that was that it reduced nitrogen deposition in the atmosphere. biosphere, which means fewer nutrients should be going to lakes. But again, we didn't see, on the whole, improvements in water quality, and we think that's because we're facing other changes that are worsening water quality.
We're talking to Samantha Oliver from the UW-Madison Department of Limnology, looking at a new study that she's the author of, looking at water quality in about 3,000 lakes in the United States, and seeing water quality generally staying the same, despite efforts to improve it and despite growing threats to that quality. And Samantha, I think a lot of times a water protection effort might be on this lake or this shoreline or this river. Are you trying to get a more global perspective on threats facing water in general?
Yeah, and we think this broader perspective is really important because you might have a farmer doing something on the landscape to improve water quality, but does what that farmer is doing doesn't necessarily translate to, say, oxygen depletion in the Gulf of Mexico, because waterways are connected. And sort of the challenges that we face environmentally are really broad scale. So climate change isn't just happening to one lake or a few lakes. It's happening to all lakes, and climate is changing differently in different places. And so you sort of have to zoom out to get a broader perspective of what we can expect in the future for water quality.
Talk about climate change. I'm sure that's hard to measure as far as a direct impact on things like nutrients in a lake, but in general, what kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, so I'll use the Yahara watershed here in Madison as an example. So we know that the watershed is a really progressive place to live in terms of water quality management. The managers are doing really innovative things like having the sewage district pay farmers to mitigate nutrients on the landscape instead of spending money on upgrading technology, for example. But those efforts are up against things like increases in the number of extreme precipitation days in a given year. And every time it rains really hard in Madison, we get a big influx of nutrients into the lakes. And that's pretty universal about how we understand how climate change will affect water quality. We generally think more nutrients are going to end up in the lake. It's going to be warmer, which means worsening water quality.
What do we know about how water quality has changed over the long haul? You started this in about 1990. I know in Madison, there's the longest studied lake in the world, probably Lake Mendota, because of your department. What do we know about the changes in water quality over the long haul?
Yeah, it's really important to consider sort of the timing of this study as 1990 and onward. But a lot of changes happened prior to 1990. So the Clean Water Act, for example, in the 1970s, really cleaned up point source pollution. So many people might not know, but previously, we discharged our sewage directly into the Madison Lakes. And so there were huge nutrient and algal bloom problems in the lakes that were largely cleaned up after the Clean Water Act. And so, you know, water quality in the Madison Lakes, we might perceive it as still being bad, but it's actually improved since those days, but it's just not where we want it to be.
Is it possible to take success stories for local water quality preservation efforts and start to replicate them in other lakes and rivers?
Yeah, that's a really hard challenge. One of the things about managing water quality at really broad spatial scales is that some of the local improvements don't tend to scale up. So if a farmer, for example, puts a buffer strip around a stream so that nutrients don't directly run into the stream, you can measure improvements in that stream. But if you move downstream, down a couple streams, oftentimes those efforts don't scale up. So really, we do need these national scale policies if we want to improve water quality at that scale. So I think there are some things to be learned locally, and those efforts aren't wasted, certainly. But we're going to have to do more than just the local scale to improve national water quality.
Yeah, what kind of federal efforts, whether that's regulations or incentives, I guess, could make a difference, not just in one stream or lake?
Yeah, so right now, the primary way that we manage water quality from an agricultural perspective is by offering incentives. So it's sort of an opt-in approach. It's not a regulatory approach. And those are generally more popular than regulatory approaches. And they do work. There's evidence that they can improve water quality. But again, they're optional and they don't scale up.
So as somebody presumably who's interested in the outcome of all this, I mean, looking at your research, we talked about that glass half full, glass half empty, but looking ahead, coming out of this research, do you feel optimistic that we're going to see improvements around the country in water quality?
I'm middle line, I think. I kind of had a glass half empty, treading water sort of perspective. I wasn't necessarily surprised by these findings, but it is disheartening to know the amount of money that the United States spends on water quality, and just knowing that that isn't nearly enough. And so it's going to take a lot of investment to improve water quality.
So if you were talking to a policymaker, what would you want them to take home, whether it's at the state or federal level? Take home from your research?
Yeah, I think one of the unique challenges of lake water quality in particular is that lakes sort of behave individually. So you can't just, with a broad brush, say how lakes are going to change under climate scenarios, for example. How big a lake is, how deep it is, changes how it responds to these drivers. And so national scale efforts to monitor water quality and improve water quality are really important. This study wouldn't have been possible if it weren't for sort of open science efforts to give us their data. I didn't go to 3,000 lakes and collect those data. And so these initiatives to monitor water quality at the national scale are really important.
Samantha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Samantha Oliver, graduate student in UW-Madison's Limnology Department, talking about her study that found conditions in Midwestern lakes have remained largely the same despite a changing environment. Coming up, Wisconsin National Guard troops were called to active duty for response to Hurricane Irma. We'll learn more about their deployment after news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Wisconsin National Guard troops deploying to help with hurricane recovery. First, President Trump's recent decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program has reignited a debate over how much immigration costs U.S. taxpayers. Critics say the cost is too high, but what benefits do they actually receive in Wisconsin? Alexandra Hall went to find out.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling the Capital Consortium.
Sean Tessman is standing near the edge of a sea of gray cubicles where her staff answer phone calls from people seeking public benefits.
Today is a relatively busy day. We expect to get about 2,000 phone calls.
Tessman is an administrator at the Dane County Job Center. She says when it comes to the benefits immigrants qualify for,
it can be complicated.
Tessman says welfare reform in 1996 limited the federal benefits that immigrants who are in the country legally can receive. Since then, each state has come up with its own rules. In Wisconsin, she says, it basically boils down to this.
Generally speaking, even legal immigrants, unless they have been here and have had that qualified status for a minimum of 5 years, they generally will not qualify as adults for these benefit programs, even though their children might.
That's how it works with programs like FoodShare, Wisconsin's version of food stamps. Lawful permanent residents who have had a green card for less than 5 years and people who are in the country illegally, they can't use FoodShare. But sometimes their kids can. There are other exceptions, like with BadgerCare, Wisconsin's health coverage for low-income residents.
People, even without that 5-year waiting period, can still qualify for emergency medical care if something catastrophic happens. And pregnant women can also qualify for prenatal care.
The costs and benefits of immigration are at the forefront of the national debate. Last month, the Trump administration endorsed the RAISE Act, a proposal that aims to cut legal immigration by half over the next decade. Here's senior policy advisor Stephen Miller announcing the RAISE Act to reporters at the White House.
Every year we issue 1 million green cards to foreign nationals from all the countries of the world, but we do so without regard to whether that applicant has demonstrated the skill that can add to the U.S. economy, whether they can pay their own way or be reliant on welfare.
The National Academy of Sciences recently looked into this by comparing how much immigrants pay in taxes to how much they use in government services. Kim Rubin is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute who worked on that report.
In general, immigrants are good for the federal bottom line. For state and local governments, the story is a little more mixed, and that's largely because immigrants have more kids. And so as they grow up, those children will become workers and become part of the labor force. But in the short term, they are expensive largely because of the cost of education.
The Supreme Court ruled in 1982 that all students are entitled to a free public education regardless of immigration status. Rubin says it's true. Educating the children of immigrants costs taxpayers money in the short term. But looking at the bigger picture, she says, it's a worthy investment, especially when those kids grow up.
We also found in the report that the children of immigrants, so those second generation, are actually the people who are giving the most in terms of paying taxes versus using services over the long run.
So how much is all of this costing taxpayers? Well, it depends on the program and each individual's immigration status. Last year, emergency room visits and prenatal care provided through Badger Care, which immigrants can take advantage of, only accounted for less than 0.5% of all money spent on Medicaid in Wisconsin. Alexandra Hall, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Hurricane Irma moved through Florida and into the southeastern United States over the last few days, leaving a trail of severe flooding, damage, and debris. As the area looks to recover, it'll have some help from the Badger State. Wisconsin National Guard troops have been pulled into active duty to help respond to Hurricane Irma. I want to invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been called in with National Guard or utility company or other effort to disaster relief around the country? Are you being deployed right now, or is someone in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Meg Jones is with us, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She covered the deployment of these National Guard troops. Meg, welcome back to Central Time. Well, I see the number's gone down. It was going to be 2,500. Now it looks like about 650 Wisconsin National Guard troops. Can you first of all talk about the units involved? What kind of groups would be sent down from Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, the initial call-up was for a little bit over 2,500 people, and that included the largest unit in the state of Wisconsin. That's the 32nd Red Arrow combat team, and that's more than 1,000 people, and they're from they're comprised from units from all over the state of Wisconsin. But there's artillery units and infantry units and transportation units that got called up. They had been put on notice for Hurricane Harvey, but as you know, Hurricane Harvey was a much smaller area. I mean, it was quite devastating for Houston and some of the other areas, but I think. But then they ended up not getting called in for Harvey. So when I talked to a unit yesterday in Oconomowoc, they're pretty excited because they had kind of gotten, you know, prepared themselves for Hurricane Harvey and then got called, you know, and said to stand down. And then now they were getting called down to Florida because, you know, as you know, Florida was a much more spread out area, and that's why they needed more troops down there.
Have we seen Wisconsin National Guard units deployed to hurricane relief areas before?
Yep, it's fairly common for National Guard from other states to get called in for major catastrophes like hurricanes. So, for example, during Hurricane Katrina in 2005, there were several hundred Wisconsin National Guard units that were sent down to New Orleans, to Mississippi, around that area, including I know a helicopter unit was sent down there as well too. So it kind of what happens is that the governor of whatever state or states that are undergoing this catastrophe, they get on a conference call with their counterparts from other states, and they get, and this is usually it's even done before the hurricane hits or the storm hits, and they kind of go over like, well, how many people can you put in, and that's what was done for Wisconsin. So Governor Walker had been contacted last week already that if needed that, you know, could the National Guard go down? And he said, of course. So it's all kind of done ahead of time, and then a lot of time. Now I think what's happening today is that as they're getting in to assess the damage, now they're getting a better idea what needs help, where do people need to be still rescued or to be taken into, and probably their numbers are ratcheting down because they don't need quite as many people.
Are Wisconsin troops already on their way or already in place? Some of them.
That went on Sunday, and then there was quite a number of folks that left yesterday as well. So I was in Oconomowoc with Charlie Battery of the 1st Battalion 120th Field Artillery, and it's a relatively new unit. They just formed 2 years ago, so the vast majority of the 100 or so people that are in the unit had never deployed anywhere before. So when I was speaking to the soldiers yesterday, they were pretty excited because they said, you know, this is why I joined the National Guard. I wanted to help. I wanted to serve. And, you know, you train and you want to be able to put the training into use. So they're all pretty excited and pumped. And fortunately for them, it's an artillery unit. So they've got these very large trucks that are normally hauling howitzer guns, very large weapons, which, of course, they left behind because they won't need that down in Florida. But these trucks sit up very high. And so they're kind of called high water trucks. And they're perfect for driving through flooded areas for rescue or to bring people in or to bring supplies in.
Now, this is part of life, I guess, if you're in the National Guard. You might suddenly be called up and all plans are off. What kind of things did you hear from people who are getting ready to go about what it was like to shut down their lives, basically, in preparation to head down to Florida?
Well, there's kind of prep for this. I mean, when you join the National Guard, you know that you could be called up for any sort of calamity, or especially during the Iraq and the height of the Afghan wars, they were, you know, leaving for a lot longer time and heading over to war duty. But for this, I mean, obviously they didn't know in advance, you know, several weeks ago that these hurricanes would be coming through. And I know in this particular unit, the commander said some people had weddings that they had to put on hold. Some people had family members that were in hospitals. They had some people were going to be missing anniversaries. And, of course, being in the National Guard, you also have your civilian life, too. So National Guard means you've got drill weekend once a month where you go Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But that's just 1 week in a month. And then a couple of weeks usually in the summertime for advanced training. So most of them are have jobs or are students. So I talked to one UWM student who literally just started her classes, and she had to talk to her professors and say, "Well, I'm going." She said all of them were very supportive, and she planned to try and keep up with her studies online. But she just didn't know how busy she was going to be, or you know how. And the other thing was is that they don't know how long that they're going to be down there for. I mean, it could be literally days, it could be weeks, it could be as much as a couple of months.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She stays with us to talk about the role Wisconsin National Guard troops are playing in hurricane recovery in Florida, some of them down there as we speak. And you can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Have you ever traveled to an area to help as it recovers from a disaster, whether with the National Guard yourself, if you're a utility line person? Have you done this kind of work? I know there are Wisconsinites down in, I think, still Texas and probably Florida now, too, doing work to help bring the power back online. If you've done this, share your experience. If you have a family member down there doing work right now, I'd love to hear from you about what they're doing down there. And if you've been in a natural disaster, what kind of support was needed to aid in recovery? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the deployment of Wisconsin National Guard troops to areas battered by Hurricane Irma. About 650 of them now, it looks like, will be sent down to help out in Florida. Meg Jones is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. send an invitation out to you at 800-642-1234. If you've done this before, if you have been in the National Guard and done disaster relief, utility work in disaster-affected areas, on the off chance, if you're already down there doing work, you happen to be listening to us and you're on break, definitely call in right now, 800-642-1234. Or if you have a family member who is down there helping or on their way, just got called up for the National Guard, 800-642-1234 would be the number to call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Meg, you have done work with National Guard units before, people getting ready to be deployed to Afghanistan. I think you went over at one point. Are we seeing some of the same people who might have been in Afghanistan doing training and other duties now being called up for this work in Florida?
This year, the Wisconsin National Guard has had troops that were called up to South Korea, to Afghanistan, to Southwest Asia, and there are troops that are overseas right now. So the unit that I spent time with yesterday to write a story about, very few of them had deployed before. That's why I think they were pretty excited about it. But there are quite a number of people that are continuing to serve in the National Guard who have done multiple tours of duty in Afghanistan and probably also Iraq. Those will probably be the folks that have been in the longest, or maybe even the warrant officers or the officers. But yeah, it was interesting. I remember in 2005 when there was several hundred Wisconsin National Guard members that got sent down to Katrina, because at that time there was an infantry battalion that was going through training in Mississippi, and they had to take. So these are guys that are training to go over to Iraq, and they were caught in Hurricane Katrina, and they had to take cover in some barracks at a fort down there. But one guy did get injured when he went outside to smoke a cigarette, and he got hit by some flying debris. Wow. Because the reason I remember this is that a few months later, I was over in Iraq with those units, and they were talking about, like, yeah, you know, we didn't think we'd face, like, the biggest amount of danger before we even left American soil to come over to Iraq, so which I thought was kind of funny.
Let's take a caller now. Melissa is on the line in Baraboo. Melissa, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Melissa?
Well, it's funny. I was just listening to your guest, and I remember the incident she talked about really clearly with that soldier during Katrina who was injured, because my husband right now is with the advanced unit down in Florida, but he was a part of that deployment as well. And whenever something like that happens, they activate the phone tree and call all family members to let us know that someone has been injured. And I remember when that phone tree activation went out, and we weren't expecting to hear at that point that anything had happened to a family member. And it was very, very stressful. And I'm sure for family members who are in Florida, it's the same situation where, you know, a lot of our husbands and family members and wives and brothers and sisters have deployed before. And when they've deployed overseas, you're really ready for them to be a part of active duty and the families are active. But something like this, you're unprepared. We don't have a phone tree set up. You know, it's sort of, for them, and I think for families too, we're a little bit out of our element.
Melissa, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. Good luck to your husband and his comrades down there in Florida as they go down to do work in Florida. It's peacetime, Meg, but it is still a stressful situation for National Guard members and their families, isn't it?
I went to Iraq or Afghanistan, I usually contacted the family readiness coordinators from whatever units I'd be embedded with. So I got to know some of the family members, and then of course I was embedded over in Iraq and Afghanistan with the units. And the guys and gals that were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, they would always tell me, you know, I think this is much, you know, the deployment is much worse on our families because they don't know what we're doing. And, you know, they would call in or Skype, but they couldn't really go into a lot of details about, you know, the missions. And they said, you know, we over here in Iraq know exactly what we're doing. We know the danger. We know when we're going to be out, but our families don't. And what that lady was just saying was that, you know, you'd get a phone call and you would just kind of freeze up because you didn't know what was happening, if somebody was wounded or something like that. And to a lesser extent, but also stressful, These folks are going into, they don't know what they're going into down in Florida. I mean, there's some of the areas they haven't been able even to, there's areas of the Keys where they haven't even been able to go into and find out exactly what's happening. So these folks, they're in their vehicles, they're heading down to Florida now as we speak, or they're there now, but they don't know where exactly they're going to be deployed. They don't know exactly what they'll be doing, whether it's search and rescue or whether it's humanitarian aid or security. They just don't know. So I think partly that stress is just from not knowing.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Meg Jones is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She covered Wisconsin National Guard troops going to Florida, some already in Florida, dealing with hurricane relief. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one have deployed for the National Guard for disaster relief, utility repair, if you have a loved one down there now doing this kind of work, 800-642-1234. Megan is with us now in Jefferson County. Megan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Megan?
Well, my youngest son is in the Wisconsin National Guard, and he is very, very excited to be leaving. They told him on Saturday during drill that he'd be going, and they haven't left yet, but he's pretty excited. He's the youngest of four boys, and his older brother was in the Air Force, and in fact, right before he went into the Air Force, he got involved in Katrina, the older boy, my older son. And after that, he went into the Air Force, and he ended up being killed in Afghanistan. So my youngest son is just, all very determined to do anything he can to make a difference for people and pick up the slack where, Dan only had a few years.
Megan, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. I'm sorry for your loss, and thanks to you and your family for the service. Meg, you've met a lot of National Guard members. This kind of thing often runs in the family, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely, especially National Guard, because, you can, as opposed to the active military where you're assigned to a particular unit and you're with people from all across the country, National Guard units are from your armory is in a particular community. And a lot of times that unit and that armory have been there for not just decades, but probably even more than a century. And so it's quite common to have, family members all serving in the same unit, having several generations serving in the same unit. And there's much more of a kind of a family-like atmosphere because, you have your biological family, but you also have your military family, and they become just as close because you're working and training next to each other. And I'm guessing that for all the people that are going to be heading down or already are in Florida, it's going to be a great bonding experience for them going into this devastation, the hurricane, but putting their training to use and making them feel like they're actually making a difference.
Megan, thanks, and good luck to your younger son as he heads down to Florida to help out. And Meg, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. That's Meg Jones, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to look at the work some Wisconsin National Guard troops will be doing to help Floridians recover from Hurricane Irma. If you have a story like this yourself, if you are deploying, if a loved one is deploying, still time to share your story on Twitter at Central Time WPR or over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the details on a big Wisconsin Senate vote on the Foxconn deal and the new state budget. Things are moving quickly, it sounds like, this afternoon and evening. We'll get the latest that we know at that time. We'll look at the ethical concerns of technology companies courting teachers to use and promote their products in the classroom. And we'll hear about the new concessions on offer at Lambeau Field. Get ready for Elk Stroganoff and more. Plus, it's our weekly look at some of the biggest stories in national news. Paul Singer from USA Today is back with us, congressional reporter. He'll give us the latest on, the debt ceiling, the White House, a lot going on out there. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.